I learned early in this job that violence doesn't always announce itself with chaos, because sometimes it arrives quietly, already moving, already decided, and by the time anyone realizes what is happening, the moment has narrowed so completely that there is no room left for escape, no margin for reconsideration, only motion and consequence, bound together in a way that cannot be untangled afterwards. In this case, what reached my desk did not begin as a homicide file, but as a sequence of ordinary actions reviewed in reverse. A roadway, a bicycle, a vehicle that should have passed and continued on, in a brief confrontation that did not end where it started because it refused to stay contained. When I reviewed the evidence, what struck me was not speed or volume or spectacle, but persistence. The fact that one person disengaged and tried to leave, and another followed, closing distance that did not need to be closed, carrying intent forward even after the moment to stop had already passed. By the time I understood how the final seconds unfolded, the outcome was fixed, the loss irreversible, and the name on the file was Tyler Morell. I did not encounter Tyler Morell as a headline or a statistic, but as a person reconstructed through records, statements, and the ordinary details that surface when you take the time to look backward carefully rather than rushing ahead to conclusions. The materials I reviewed describe the young man who rode his bicycle regularly, not as a statement or a provocation, but as a routine part of his day, something that fit naturally into how he moved through the world. When I examined the reports, there was nothing remarkable about that choice on its own, because bicycles share roads with cars every day without incident, and most of the time, those encounters pass without leaving any trace at all. The roadway where this case unfolded was not remote or unfamiliar to law enforcement, and it was not known as a site of repeated violence, which matters because context often explains more than any single action does. Traffic moved through it daily, people commuted, ran errands, and returned home, and there was no indication that the setting itself carried a heightened risk that afternoon. As I reviewed the environmental factors, including lighting, visibility, and traffic flow, nothing suggested an unavoidable danger, only the usual conditions that require patience and restraint from everyone sharing the space. From the statements gathered, it was clear that Tyler was traveling by bicycle when an interaction occurred with the driver of a vehicle, an interaction that began as a dispute rather than an attack. Roadway confrontations are unfortunately common, and most of them resolve without injury, because one or both parties disengage, choose distance over dominance, and allow time to absorb whatever frustration sparked the moment. That expectation, that the encounter would remain brief and limited, is what makes this case so difficult to reconcile after the fact. I reviewed the initial accounts carefully, paying attention to what was consistent across witnesses and what varied, because truth often reveals itself through repetition rather than drama. What remained steady was that Tyler did not initiate prolonged contact and did not pursue the other individual once the first exchange ended. Instead, the evidence showed that he attempted to continue on his way, increasing distance rather than reducing it, which is an important distinction when assessing how the situation evolved. When I examined Tyler's background as it appeared in official records, there was nothing to suggest a pattern of aggression or conflict, and nothing that indicated he expected the interaction to escalate beyond words. Friends and family described him as someone engaged in his own life, focused on work, relationships, and routine, not someone seeking confrontation or attention. That grounding matters because it places his actions within the realm of normal behavior, rather than framing them as part of a volatile pattern. The other individual involved in the case entered my awareness not as a personality, but as a series of documented actions tied to a vehicle, a route, and a timeline. At this stage in the review, I focused strictly on what could be established through evidence rather than inferred through emotion, because speculation has a way of filling gaps that facts have not earned the right to occupy. What the record showed was that after the initial encounter, the vehicle did not continue away from Tyler's path, but instead followed. That decision, to pursue rather than disengage, marked the point where the situation shifted from a shared moment of roadway tension to something far more dangerous. Pursuit changes the nature of responsibility, because it requires ongoing choice, repeated decisions to continue rather than stop, and awareness that distance is being closed deliberately. When I reconstructed the route, using available data, including witness observations and physical evidence, The pattern was consistent with intentional following rather than coincidence. I want to be clear about something that the evidence made plain, which is that this was not an unavoidable collision of pads, but a sequence of movements that required effort to maintain. Tyler's bicycle did not loop back or reverse direction toward the vehicle, and there was no indication that he attempted to prolong contact. Instead, the distance between them should have increased, but it did not, and that failure of separation is central to understanding what came next. As I reviewed the timeline, I noted that there were multiple moments where the situation could have ended without harm, moments that existed not in hindsight but in real time, where stopping, turning away, or simply continuing forward would have broken the chain of events. Those moments mattered not because they changed the outcome, which they cannot, but because they demonstrate that escalation was not inevitable. Each continued action narrowed the range of possible endings until only one remained. Before the violence occurred, there was no evidence of a pre-existing relationship between Tyler and the individual who followed him. No history that tied them together beyond that single encounter. This was not a dispute carried over from the past or fueled by a personal grievance that had been building over time. It was an interaction born entirely of circumstance, which makes its resolution all the more stark because it depended solely on choices made in minutes rather than years. When I reviewed the witness statements again, focusing on what people noticed before anything irreversible happened, I was struck by how ordinary their observations were. A bicycle moving along the road, a vehicle nearby, raised voices reported briefly, then movement continuing. Nothing about those descriptions suggested that a fatal outcome was imminent, which aligns with how quickly such situations can turn when restraint gives way to pursuit. By the time I closed the first phase of the file, what I understood was that Tyler Morell's final journey began like countless others, with no indication that it ended in violence. He was not isolated, not hidden from view, and not engaged in behavior that signaled danger. The shift from normalcy to catastrophe did not occur because of environment or chance, but because a moment that could have ended was instead carried forward. That is where the record leaves us, before everything changed. At the point where separation should have occurred and did not, where a road shared by strangers became the setting for a decision that would follow Tyler beyond that intersection and into the final moments of his life. By the time I turned fully to the central incident, the part of the file that documented the fatal encounter itself, I already understood that nothing about it unfolded suddenly, even though the violence did. What I had in front of me was a sequence of movements, confirmations, and recorded observations that showed continuity rather than rupture. A situation carried forward step by step until it reached a point where there was no space left for it to resolve safely. This chapter of the case was not defined by confusion in the evidence, but by clarity, because the actions that mattered were visible, trackable, and supported by more than one source. The first thing I did was align the timelines, not to dramatize them, but to remove any ambiguity about order and distance. Witness statements, physical locations, and the condition of the roadway all confirmed that after the initial exchange, Tyler continued riding, maintaining forward motion consistent with someone trying to disengage rather than re-engage. There was no evidence of erratic riding, no indication that he stopped to confront or circle back, and nothing in the record suggested he believed the encounter would follow him beyond that point. The vehicle, however, did not diverge. That was established not only through witness observations but through the spatial relationship documented afterward, which showed that the driver altered his path to remain aligned with Tyler's direction of travel. Following is not a momentary act, and the evidence reflected that, because it required sustained attention, repeated steering decisions, and an awareness of the cyclist's movement over distance. When I reviewed the diagrams and photographs, the consistency of that alignment stood out more than any single act of aggression. What happened next occurred quickly, but not without context. The vehicle closed the gap to a point where the separation between car and bicycle no longer served as a barrier. The evidence showed that the driver exited the vehicle, which is significant because it marks a transition from roadway interaction to physical pursuit on foot. That choice mattered because it eliminated the last remaining layer of distance that could have allowed the encounter to end without contact. At this stage of the investigation, I focused heavily on what could be confirmed without interpretation. Tyler was still moving when the driver approached him, and the encounter did not occur at a fixed, predetermined location, but along the path of travel itself. There was no indication that Tyler stopped voluntarily to continue the argument, and the evidence supported the conclusion that the confrontation was forced by proximity rather than neutral agreement. The stabbing itself was documented through medical findings, witness testimony, and the physical evidence recovered at the scene. I will not describe the act in detail, because the facts do not require embellishment to be understood. What mattered was that the injuries were consistent with a close-range assault, and that they occurred during the confrontation initiated after the pursuit. The medical examiner's conclusions established cause of death clearly, leaving no uncertainty about the outcome of that moment. When I reviewed the emergency response records, they reinforced how narrow the window was between injury and collapse. First responders arrived to a scene already shaped by what had just occurred, not by what was still unfolding. Their observations confirmed the severity of Tyler's condition and the immediacy with which aid was attempted. There was no prolonged interval where intervention could have altered the result once the injuries were sustained, which underscored how decisive that brief encounter had been. The presence of recording evidence, referenced internally as part of the case file, did not provide a cinematic narrative, but it did provide confirmation. Whether from surveillance, bystander capture, or other documented sources, the recordings aligned with witness accounts rather than contradicting them. They showed movement, proximity, and escalation, but not chaos or confusion, and they supported the conclusion that Tyler was pursued rather than ambushed or surprised at static location. As I reviewed that material, what struck me was how ordinary the setting appeared, even as the consequences became extraordinary. There were no visual cues that suggested the road had transformed into something else, no barriers or warnings that signaled danger to anyone else passing through. The violence occurred within an environment that looked like countless others, which reinforced the fact that the escalation was carried by human action rather than circumstance. The suspect's actions immediately following the stabbing were documented with the same clarity as those leading up to it. The records showed separation from the scene, attempts to create distance, and subsequent law enforcement involvement that followed established investigative procedures. These details mattered because they completed the sequence of events without leaving unresolved gaps that might invite speculation. When law enforcement took control of the scene, they did so with an understanding of what had already been established through witness cooperation and physical evidence. The roadway was secured, the bicycle documented where it came to rest, and the vehicle involved was identified through descriptions that matched independently gathered information. This convergence of detail reduced uncertainty and allowed investigators to move forward without relying on conjecture. Throughout this phase, Tyler remained present in the investigation not as an abstraction, but as a person whose final actions could be traced with care. He rode forward, he attempted to leave, and he did not reinitiate contact. Those facts were supported repeatedly across the file, and they formed the foundation of how the case was understood legally and procedurally. The charging documents reflected that understanding by focusing on pursuit and intent as established through behavior rather than statements. The decision to follow, to exit the vehicle, and to engage physically were treated as connected actions rather than isolated impulses. That continuity mattered because it showed that the fatal moment did not stand alone, but was the culmination of choices made in sequence. As I finished reviewing the materials related directly to the stabbing, I noted how little room there was for alternative interpretations once the evidence was laid out fully. This was not a case built on conflicting narratives or unclear causation. It was a case built on movement, distance, and the refusal to let an encounter end when it still could have. The tape, the records, and the statements did not add drama, and they did not need to. They showed what happened in a way that resisted distortion, grounding the case in facts that were both sufficient and final. By the time I closed that portion of the file, the central moment of the case was no longer defined by shock, but by inevitability created through pursuit. What remained was not mystery, but consequence, and that consequence would shape everything that followed, not only in courtrooms and reports, but in the permanent absence left behind when Tyler Morrell did not return from a ride that should have ended like any other. After the central incident was documented and the immediate investigation stabilized, the case entered a different phase, one defined less by motion and more by process, where actions were measured in paperwork, court filings, and verified outcomes rather than distance and speed. This stage matters because it is where facts are tested formally, where conclusions must withstand scrutiny, and where the record becomes fixed in a way that does not change with retelling. When I reviewed this portion of the file, I approached it with the same discipline as the earlier stages, focusing on what was confirmed and what could be demonstrated without inference. Law enforcement procedures following the homicide proceeded according to established protocol, beginning with the formal identification of the suspect and the securing of all relevant evidence. The vehicle involved was located and examined, and items of interest were catalogued and preserved in a manner consistent with evidentiary standards. The chain of custody was documented clearly, which is important because it ensures that the physical record of the case remains intact from collection through adjudication. Interviews conducted during this phase did not introduce new uncertainty but reinforced what had already been established. Witnesses were asked to clarify timelines and locations, not to reinterpret events, and their statements remained consistent with earlier accounts. There were no conflicting versions of the pursuit or the confrontation that required reconciliation, which allowed investigators to move forward without delay caused by evidentiary disputes. The medical findings were finalized and entered into the official record, confirming cause of death and the nature of the injuries without qualification. These conclusions aligned with what had been observed at the scene and during emergency response, and they did not rely on hypothetical mechanisms or disputed interpretations. Once those findings were complete, the medical aspect of the case was considered resolved in terms of factual determination. Charging decisions reflected the totality of the evidence, rather than any single element. Prosecutors relied on the documented sequence of pursuit, the forced confrontation, and the resulting fatal injury to establish the legal framework under which the case would proceed. The filings did not embellish the narrative or introduce speculative language, but instead mirrored the restrained tone of the investigative record, which is often a sign that the facts themselves are sufficient to support the charges. As the case moved through the court system, procedural milestones replaced investigative ones. Hearings were scheduled, filings submitted, and motions addressed within the boundaries of due process. This period can appear uneventful from the outside, but it is where accountability is formally pursued, and where the actions documented earlier are evaluated under law rather than observation alone. Throughout this process, Tyler Morrell's presence in the record did not diminish to a name on a docket. Victim impact materials, submitted appropriately and within legal guidelines, focused on who he was rather than on the manner of his death, emphasizing the absence created rather than the violence itself. These submissions were factual and restrained, consistent with the tone that had characterized the case from the beginning. From an investigative standpoint, there were no unresolved questions left open by the conclusion of proceedings. The route of pursuit was established, the sequence of actions confirmed, and the outcome documented beyond dispute. This completeness matters because it prevents the case from being reshaped by rumor or reinterpretation after the fact, anchoring it instead to a record that can be examined independently. When I reviewed the final disposition documents, I noted how they closed the loop that began with an ordinary roadway encounter. The language used was precise, avoiding dramatization, and focusing instead on responsibility as defined by law. There were no references to broader social commentary or abstract meaning, only to actions, consequences, and legal outcomes. The conclusion of the case did not alter the underlying facts, and it did not reframe them to create a different narrative. Tyler rode his bicycle, a confrontation occurred, he attempted to disengage, he was pursued, and he was killed. Those elements remained constant from the first report to the final filing, which is not always the case in complex investigations, but was true here. In the aftermath, the roadway itself returned to routine use, indistinguishable from how it appeared before the incident. Traffic resumed, bicycles passed through, and the environment showed no permanent marker of what had occurred there. This physical return to normalcy contrasted sharply with the permanence of the loss documented in the case file. From my perspective, what remained after the conclusion of legal proceedings was not a lesson or a warning, but a complete and closed record. The file contained everything necessary to understand how the homicide occurred and why it unfolded as it did, without leaving gaps that demanded interpretation. That completeness is rare, and it carries a weight of its own. The investigative process does not restore what was taken, and it does not attempt to. Its role is to establish truth within defined limits and to ensure that actions are addressed through the appropriate channels. In this case, that role was fulfilled without deviation from procedure or reliance on conjecture. As I finalized my review, I noted that there were no further actions pending, no appeals or supplemental investigations indicated in the materials available to me at that time. The case had reached its documented end, with outcomes recorded and responsibilities assigned according to law. What remains, then, is the factual record itself, preserved in reports, transcripts, and evidence logs, available to be reviewed without distortion. Tyler Morrell's death did not become a symbol or a parable within those pages, but a documented event with a clear beginning, middle, and end. That is where this case concludes, not with interpretation or commentary, but with finality, grounded in verified fact, the kind that does not change with retelling, and does not depend on emphasis to be understood.